You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It only feels like the presidential candidates have been running for an eternity. Over the past year or so, as the campaigns have developed, certain political narratives have emerged, and here to discuss how these narratives are formed and whether they actually help us understand the candidates are WNYC's own Brooke Gladstone, co-host of NPR's On the Media, and Paul Waldman, senior fellow at Media Matters for America and author of a number of books, including Being Right is Not Enough, and I'm very pleased to welcome them both back to the show. Hello.
Hi.
Paul, you've written a lot about these political narratives. Do you think the media are primarily responsible for their creation?
They're responsible for the creation of some narratives, but the candidates all try, if they know what they're doing, to create their own narrative that tells a story about where the country is, where they want to take the country, and perhaps most importantly, why that candidate and only that candidate is the person who can bring us to that brighter day. And I think what you find if you look back at successful candidacies of the past is they all did that very well. They told that sort of three-part narrative about who we are, where we are, what's wrong with what's happening today in the first place, and then in the second place, where we want to go, and in the third place, why that candidate is going to bring us there. The ones that succeeded all managed to do that.
So they provide us with a shorthand that the public can easily grab onto, Brooke?
Yeah, absolutely. Or at least they try to provide us with that. As Paul was saying, there's a constant struggle between the narrative that the candidate wants us to hear and the narrative, the counter-narrative that the media, although I don't like to refer to them as a monolith, will frequently construct because it's more interesting or because it's just easier to have a default mode, you know, as in, and Paul will talk about this very well, you know, George Bush is dumb, Al Gore is a liar. It's a much easier narrative. It's an easy template to write your stories around, and it's just as sticky as the as the candidates, if not more so.
And John Kerry is a flip-flopper.
Exactly. Well, but
those weren't created by the media, were they? They were created by opponents and then picked up by the media.
Certainly in the case of John Kerry. I think, and Paul, I feel like I'm walking into your area here, but in the case of Al Gore, the media just didn't like him. He didn't have a good relationship with them, and they had a lot of fun with that. I think the $400 haircut of John Edwards is more of a media obsession than it is of his competitors.
But then, Paul, I want you to comment on this. People often refer to the three H's when they talk about John Edwards. It really seems to have stuck to him, the haircut, his home, and the third one being hypocrisy.
Well, when you say that it sticks to him, we have to sort of step back and ask why that is. And part of the reason is that that reporters think it's important. Now, let's take a contrast. Mitt Romney is a guy who has very, very nice hair and has much more money than John Edwards does. He's worth probably around $250 million. But the fact that John Edwards got a haircut that was very expensive, it sort of dropped into story after story after story as just kind of a shorthand of saying, see, he's really not genuine. He's really not authentic. He says he cares about poor people, but how could he possibly care about poor people when he himself is so obviously not poor?
Exactly, and I think you've just hit on it right there. If Romney's campaign had centered around the class divide and protection of the poor, maybe his money, his haircuts, if indeed he was caught getting a $400 haircut, might figure in. You know, I agree with, I think, what you suggest implicitly and what everybody knows, which is that this $400 haircut thing is not worth anything. It doesn't mean anything, and it really has run its course. But I do think that the media do have a certain opportunity here when people are caught in what appears to be hypocritical behavior.
Right, but what we have to understand is that they make that every day journalists make choices about what they're going to mention and what they're not going to mention, what stories they're going to pick up and run with, and mm-hmm. which ones they're not going to pick up and run with. You know, you can take other examples of those things that might have been kind of emblematic. Like we talked about Romney, about there was the story about him saying that he was a hunter most of his life, and it turns out that he had just gone varmint hunting a couple of times. That's the kind of thing, a concrete incident that reporters could mention over and over and over again as one of those shorthand symbols of who they want you to think this candidate really is deep down at heart. And that one does get mentioned sometimes, but probably not as often as the haircut. And I think that we have to be careful when we notice those kinds of things coming up over and over, mm-hmm. that reporters are essentially saying to us, this is what it's all about. This is who this guy really is deep down. Because they're always on the lookout for those things that they can use as shorthand, because oftentimes the sorts of impressions that they get, the gut feelings they have about candidates, are difficult to put into a story explicitly without sounding like you're just an opinion writer and not a journalist.
But there's another side
that can symbolize them.
The expensive haircut is easy to say. You could throw it in as a parenthetical. If you wanted to go after Mitt Romney for saying that his sons did not serve in Iraq because they had a more important thing to do, which is to get him elected to be president, that takes up a lot of space, even though it could easily also be part of his political narrative.
And it allows them to put in their opinions without violating the conventions of objective journalism. So if reporters think that John Edwards is a phony, which a lot of them do, they can't write in their story, John Edwards, who is a phony, did X today. Because that would violate those conventions of objectivity. But they can just drop in a mention of the fact that he got a $400 haircut, which gives the same message and is getting their opinion across, but it doesn't jar the reader as much as it would if they just came out and said, I think he's a phony.
I love this example of who's a phony, because it comes up a lot in this particular race. And in fact, with Mitt Romney, whose views have changed so much, he could easily, phoniness could easily be incorporated into his media narrative. It is not, and the question is eventually becomes, why do some candidates remain so resistant for so long to the kind of sharp, tough criticism that others seem constantly prey to?
But also, why is it that inconsistency becomes such a big thing when we talk about these people? People do change their minds, and yet, whenever we talk about any of the candidates, we focus on some vote that they did some years back, or some statement they made in a speech before some organization some years back, as though that reveals something about where they are today.
Well, candidates, some of them go through genuine conversions over a period of time, and others...
George Bush was born again.
Yeah, for instance, that. And then you have somebody like Mitt Romney who decides out of, if you go by timing, if you go by the calendar, it seems out of pure expediency. So, you know, one change of mind is not the same as the other. And I think it's right that they aren't regarded in the same way. But that still doesn't take us to why some candidates
stick.
Attract, you know, crap and others don't.
Why do these narratives stick, do you think, Paul?
I think that the ones that stick are ones that... kind of seamlessly fit into what reporters already believe and are being pushed effectively by the opposition party. So, you know, we talked about Al Gore. The Republicans were pushing very hard the idea that he wasn't the Boy Scout that he had been portrayed as, and that he was, in fact, dishonest. And that happened to be just what reporters thought about him to begin with. So the best ones are the ones that fit into what journalists have already concluded about them. But you made a good point about this kind of fetishizing of consistency. You know, anyone who's watched Meet the Press, for instance, has seen Tim Russert put up on the screen something that a politician said 3 years ago and said, this is different from what you're saying now. Aha, I've got you. Even though it may not really be of any substance whatsoever, but that's been one of the things that reporters use to tell you that the politicians are all phony, which is kind of one of the big overarching narratives, that all politicians are false. Whenever they say anything, it's just for political advantage, that they don't have any real sentiments, that they're all trying to pull a fast one on you. And that kind of stance is very sort of knowing and cynical, but ultimately it doesn't really teach the public very much if that's the way you're going to approach all politicians.
You've been rather hard on Tim Russert. You've written about him and his role in sustaining these political narratives. Do you think that he is worse than some, or just...
More influential.
More influential. Just typical of what goes on.
I think both. He's both worse than many, and he's one of the most influential. And so that pattern of trying to find any inconsistency, no matter how trivial it is something that he has really raised to an art form. One of the other things that he does that I've written about is this kind of, again, fetishizing of his blue-collar roots. that he often, you know, will bring up the Buffalo Bills and talk about how he's from Buffalo, and you can barely get through an episode of Meet the Press without him mentioning Buffalo, which tells you that he's a real person, that he's not the one who's going to all the Washington dinner parties, even though he may actually be. That deep down, he's one of the common men because he's been in that. He comes from that blue collar background.
It's like he's running for something.
A lot of those elite journalists, like Chris Matthews and other ones, who are always talking about how important it is that they're in touch with the people. And what they then turn it around on politicians and say, well, that what we really need is authenticity. We need someone who's real, not someone who's fake and phony, but somebody who really is in touch and really knows what people are all about. The problem isn't that that's necessarily a bad thing to have, but that they seem to apply it to candidates in an almost random manner, that some they decide are authentic and some they decide just aren't. And it very seldom has any relation to reality.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And interestingly, this need for authenticity in your media figures extends beyond Russert, and it goes straight to Bill O'Reilly, who's been pointed out as having, you know, falsified his upbringing over and over and over again, creating this man of the people general persona that's got very little to do with reality.
Well,
yeah,
how far
kind of reverse snobbery?
Yeah,
how far back can we go? Because in the past, where political narrative, you've suggested political narratives have always been with us, but we didn't have all of the other people, Matt Drudge and bloggers and the like. It's been pointed out that if somebody publishes some outrageous claim in some blog somewhere, newspapers feel it's their responsibility to at least mention it.
I think to some extent, this is the horn of the dilemma that mainstream media outlets and the blogosphere have placed themselves on, and email as well. It's not just blogs. A lot of these lies come through huge email campaigns over and over again. Obama has been a great victim of this with his, been secretly trained as a Muslim commando who's going to be taking over the government as soon as he gets in, and he went to a school that trained him for these purposes, and calling him Osama, the whole deal. He's had it backwards and forwards, and it is up to the media at some point to try and dislodge some of these beliefs. I mean, many of us, my mother-in-law, almost everybody's mother-in-law has gotten, did he go to a madrasa? Is he really a Muslim, the secret agent and so on? So then you go ahead and you, CNN sent somebody out to that school where he went and talked to the headmaster, and on and on. This rumor has been exploded again and again and again. But I'm afraid that no amount of debunkings are equal to the persistence of these lies.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting case, because when the story first emerged, it came out on the website of Insight Magazine, which is owned by the Washington Times, which is owned by Reverend Sun Myung-Moon. And immediately CNN and ABC News both said, okay, well, we're not going to report on this story until we actually track it down. And so they sent, as Brooke said, they sent people to the school that he attended when he lived in Indonesia. Turns out it's not a fundamentalist madrasa, it's just an ordinary public school. And then they did stories debunking it and showing how false it was. But nonetheless, even though they did the right thing, it hasn't died. And as Brooke said, there are millions of emails circulating around saying not only that Obama went to a madrasa, but that he is some sort of Manchurian candidate sent here by Al-Qaeda, and that he's secretly a Muslim, even though he says he's a Christian. I think what that adds up to is another kind of narrative about Obama, that he's the other, he's alien, he's not one of us. That's something you often hear politicians say, that they are one of us and their opponent is not one of us. He's somehow from somewhere else. He doesn't share our values. You hear that expression all the time. It's particularly in the South, candidates will talk about having Alabama values or South Carolina values. It's a way of defining who's in and who's out, who's one of us and who's not. And I think if Obama becomes the nominee, that's going to be one of the main under the radar narratives that's going to be woven about him, is that he's the other, he's not one of us.
But it goes even further, Brooke. There was the resignation of Hillary's campaign co-chair in New Hampshire because he speculated that Senator Obama was a drug pusher. Does that hurt?
Basically, what he said is that his cocaine use, he just referenced the cocaine use, not by accusing him, I think, of being a drug pusher so much as just saying this could hurt him later in the campaign. You know, coaching it all is strategy. And it would be interesting, if I'm not getting too meta here, to talk about how the media themselves work into, not just in creating these narratives, but become part of these narratives. In the case of, you know, ever since 1983, when Pat Schroeder first applied the phrase Teflon to Ronald Reagan, whether or not you're a Teflon candidate has been a huge part of every subsequent campaign and every other candidate. And of course, where you are in the election cycle and how well you're doing will determine what level of Teflon you have and how thin it's worn. I mean, Giuliani was called a Teflon candidate. No longer is he. Even Fred Thompson was called one. Now he's not called anything at all. Ron Paul has been called one. Well, if you don't have too much stuff flying at you, what's the difference, or whether or not it can stick? Hillary is now seen as a major Teflon candidate. In the past, she was seen as pretty much, a dust magnet, and on and on. Huckabee is now seen as a Teflon candidate. Well, wait and see how far Huckabee goes, and see whether or not how many angstroms thick that Teflon turns out to be.
My guests are Brooke Gladstone, co-host of WNYC and NPR's On the Media, and Paul Waldman, senior fellow at Media Matters for America and author of most recently Being Right is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. We will continue our conversation about the development of political narratives, how they're created and how and whether some will stick better than others after we take a little break. We're back with Paul Waldman, senior fellow at Media Matters for America, and Brooke Gladstone, co-host of On the Media through WNYC and broadcast on NPR. We've been talking about narratives that apply to candidates, but what about the narratives that that everyone tries to come up with for a campaign? People have said that this current race can be summed up in one word: change. Is that the narrative that we're all living by?
Well, it certainly works itself into a lot of campaign slogans, and also we've had a long haul with this current administration, and things aren't looking very well on either the foreign or domestic front. So if you wanted to campaign on something, it would be change.
Well, how does that work for Republicans when they're platforms aren't all that different from the Bush administration's, and yet they also have to say it's time for change?
It puts them in a very awkward position because they really can't argue that strongly against the president that they've been supporting for the last 7 years. And if they want to give that coherent narrative to their own campaigns, it makes it difficult for them to say what's really wrong, because all of those narratives of successful candidates have at their heart, as a starting point, what's wrong with the country, what I want to fix. And if you asked yourself, well, what is it that Mitt Romney thinks is wrong? What does Rudy Giuliani think is wrong? What does Mike Huckabee think is wrong? It's hard to say, really. They've kind of nibbled around the edges of being critical of the administration. But Romney is the only one who's even come close, and he sort of gives an old story that we've heard from Republicans for many decades now about how Washington is full of waste and fraud and taxes are too high, and he, as the successful business leader, is going to come in and kind of clean things up and be more efficient and make everything run better. That's about as close as any of the Republican candidates have come to articulating what exactly they think the problem is.
Well, Huckabee did have that famous foreign affairs article in which he talked about the arrogance of Bush's foreign policy, but you didn't get the sense he actually wrote that article.
There's the other side. The Times a few days ago lined up all the candidates and what they believe on various major issues, and Republicans, pretty much all of them except Ron Paul, are saying stay the course in Iraq, and they all are to varying degrees in support of the Bush administration's tax cuts and its approach to the economy. And since both of those areas are areas of great dissatisfaction, according to the polls with many Americans, I wonder how they get around that. Do they have to create complicated narratives to suggest that they don't believe what they believe?
Well, people like paying fewer taxes, and people like being safe. So if the Republicans can convince them that staying the course will somehow keep them safer than changing the course, then I guess they have something on which to base a campaign on. But I did think it was pretty hilarious a couple of weeks ago, or wasn't even more recently, when Bill Clinton said in some campaign stop, and if Hillary is elected, she'll send me and George H.W. Bush, Bush 41, out into the world to tell the world that America is once again open for business, at which point Bush Sr. said, and I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to go around the world telling everybody that the country is now on the right track after years of being on the wrong track.
With my own son at the helm.
The other thing that's notable about the Republicans right now is that the messages that they're sending now are probably going to change once they get to the general election. Whereas on the Democratic side, you could see them making the same exact arguments in the general election as they're making now about change. But the Republicans are now talking about things like immigration and who's more conservative. They're very red meat, conservative-based issues. And so they're probably going to have to come up with a new story once they get to the general election. But in the general election, they can tell a story that has two sides, one about why they're wonderful and one about why the Democrat is terrible. I mean, if you recall, in 2004, George W. Bush's popularity was not all that high. The Iraq War was not going all that well. But he managed to tell a story about John Kerry that was so terrifying that he won the election with a few points to spare. His message was all about how he was strong and John Kerry was weak. And that was at the heart of everything that he said about any issue. It was a very coherent, compelling story. And so a lot of what the Republicans are going to say is really dependent on who their opponent is and how they decide to characterize that person.
You wanted to add to that, or?
Well, I think that's true. I do think that probably the Democrats and the Republicans' messages always change once you realize who your actual opponent is, and once you cease trying to appeal to the base, which is the which are the primary voters, as is always noticed. I'm not sure whether I'd like to ask Paul. I mean, in this case, the narratives, as you say, of the Democratic candidates seem to be quite consistent. The successful candidates, at least according to the polls, don't appear to be trying to appeal to the base, but to the center. Kucinich is already, saying he's going to drop out. Was he
marginalized by the press or because he really wasn't a compelling candidate?
I don't think the press is all that powerful. I honestly don't think, and you'll probably get a lot of emails on this, that the press can't make or break a candidate.
Yeah, but from the very beginning, I don't know whether Dennis Kucinich had a chance or not, but we were told from the very beginning Dennis Kucinich doesn't have a chance. And so
we were told that about Howard Dean at the very beginning as well.
But that isn't that. Well, we were told Mike Huckabee didn't have a chance.
Well, I guess that's what I mean. Basically, everybody thinks the media direct the polls. The media have an impact on public opinion, to be sure. But mostly what they're trying to do is stay on track with the polls. And then you have to worry about how powerful or accurate the polls are. But I really think that's where your power nexus is and not so much the media.
My guests are, just wait a minute, Paul, please. Okay. Brooke Gladstone, co-host of On the Media, and Paul Waldman, senior fellow at Media Matters for America. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Go ahead, Paul.
What I was going to say is that the media also have an interest in telling their own kinds of stories. With candidates like Kucinich or any of the other ones who are not contending, they find that they get ignored in part because what the press wants to do is kind of winnow the field down. If you have eight candidates all competing for the presidency, that's kind of cacophonous. It's hard to weave a good story with antagonists out of that.
So we wind up with the horse race narrative.
Yeah, and if you have two candidates who are fighting it out, then that's really the kind of story that we're familiar with. It's one person versus another person, and that lends itself very well to the kind of narratives that we understand and that the press likes to write. So the stories that the press writes are the same kinds of familiar stories that we've all grown up with, and so their interest is in deciding who they can stop covering and ignore so that they can get down to those couple of candidates and have all the focus on those personalities and that clash between them.
That is certainly true. It's very complicated to cover eight races equally, and nobody ever tries. I don't know whether that is a question of just laziness on the part of the press or whether it has to do with simply making things clear. I mean, you can on the internet, you have an opportunity to offer in-depth views. But as long as there are space considerations in newspapers and on television newscasts, you're going to see this impulse.
Right. So part of it is about those scarce resources, the amount of space they have in their broadcast or on their page, and the amount of money they want to spend on having, you know, 8 different camera crews trail 8 different candidates around. All of those come into play.
And so in Iowa, on the Republican side, it's down to Mitt Romney and Mike Huckabee. The Democrats, it's gotten a little more complicated because it was Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and John Edwards has nosed himself into that. Mm-hmm. When we get to New Hampshire, it'll be John McCain and whoever wins in Iowa. And the Democrats, it'll be Hillary and whoever comes in first or second in Iowa. And that's the way we'll keep on doing it. But one of the other big narratives here is experience. And that becomes Barack Obama has been attacked again and again for not having enough experience in foreign affairs. Bill Clinton had no foreign policy experience when he ran for president the first time. In fact, he ran on the economy. It's the economy, stupid. George Bush had no experience with foreign policy. It was pointed out he hadn't even traveled very much outside the United States when he moved into the White House. I don't know what that proves, but I think we've often voted for people who hadn't had much foreign policy experience. Does it really matter, or is it just part of the political narrative? You say what you got to say to try to get a leg up.
Well, I think, and I know Paul will agree with me here because I know we've talked about it, is people really can't campaign very well on resumes. Hillary can argue her resume, but ultimately she isn't going to win on her resume.
Well, her resume is her husband.
Yeah, or Romney on his, or Biden on his. Who has one everybody considers to be among the most impressive resumes, or certainly... Bill Richardson,
they both have a lot of foreign policy experience.
But that's not why people vote. People vote for people who seem to represent who they think America ought to be. The public face of America, people who seem to reflect their views, their values, and I don't mean in the narrow, value voter sense, but in the sense of what they think is important. Are they honest? Are they fair? Do they care about the things that I care about? It's not so much about, were you true in your marriage or something like that. I think that those sorts of things can be exaggerated. But I really do think that people vote for people who are like them, who they want to represent America, and not on the basis of their experience.
Yeah, there's a lot of research in political science that shows quite clearly that issues don't matter as much as those kinds of personal qualities. And experience is one of those personal qualities, but it's only one of them. And so when people go into the voting booth, they have kind of a gut feeling that they've accumulated over the course of the campaign about that person, that candidate that they're going to vote for. And they also have a feeling about how their vote is going to make them feel about themselves. What does my voting for this person say about me? If you're voting for Barack Obama, that may be saying about you that you want to get past the divisions of the 1960s and the partisanship in Washington. If you're voting for Mike Huckabee in this primary, that may say about you that you're a person of strong Christian faith, and that's why you're voting for Mike Huckabee. All the successful presidential candidates of the past have understood what that vote for them was supposed to say about that individual voter, what it meant for how I think about myself as an American, as a citizen, just as a person. And so all of those things that end up mattering a lot more than what the lines on the resume are.
Well, can we talk a bit about Rudolph Giuliani? Because you mentioned earlier, Brooke, the Teflon thing mm-hmm. that had been attached to him, no longer. But for a long time, it did seem like he was getting unbalanced coverage. For example, the New York Times gave more coverage to the problems of the Democratic fundraiser Norman Shue than to Rudolph Giuliani's South Carolina state campaign chair, who was indicted for conspiracy to distribute crack.
Mm-hmm.
And he seemed to have been getting a free ride until very recently, and now suddenly everybody seems to be on his neck. Is it because he's no longer seen as the front runner, and so he's vulnerable?
Well, it's interesting, because normally when you become a front runner is when you become vulnerable. In the case of Rudolph Giuliani, it is true that before people got to know him, they thought and they only knew him as America's mayor during 9/11, that he was regarded so favorably in the various places he went that I think that the mainstream press, or rather at least the New York press, stepped aside a little bit, thinking perhaps they couldn't be objective on Giuliani. We've had some discussions along those lines those go on in local newsrooms all over New York City. So I think that's part of the problem. The people who knew Giuliani best stood back for a little while. I also do think that there is a question of media narrative here, in that what the media were saying about Giuliani after a while is that he is the 9/11 candidate. He's turned himself into a one-note Charlie, and you can bring up all these examples of how he managed to connect 9/11 to ethanol and 9/11 to, you know, tax rates and 9/11 to virtually
as
everything.
As Joe Biden joked.
As Joe Biden.
A noun, a verb, and 9/11. Any sentence from Rudy Giuliani.
And but it was, you know, it's certainly Biden didn't originate this idea, although he put it to good effect. It did become part of his of Giuliani's media narrative, and I think people are now just wise to it. He's run out of steam on every other issue.
Well, there's another dynamic going on here too, which is that you see with almost every candidate that their local press and the place they come from is much tougher on them than the national press. The Arizona press is extremely tough on John McCain.
So why wasn't the Times?
The same way. And the Arkansas press is tough on Mike Huckabee. But the New York press is read by all reporters everywhere. And so when the New York Daily News, the New York Times steps up and does very critical articles about Giuliani, everyone is going to notice it. And they did hold their fire for a while, but like pretty much everybody in New York, once you are exposed to Giuliani for a long time, you get a much more nuanced view of him than him just walking around on September 11th.
Nice euphemism use.
Now, why would somebody like Joe Biden never take off? What is the narrative that's been attached to him?
Well, Paul, I'm going to jump ahead of you here and say that he does seem to be a bit of a loose cannon. Mm-hmm. I mean, he will say things that
Obama statement was rather embarrassing.
You know, that Obama's articulate. And then, you know, there were a few years ago when he had a slight plagiarism problem. But, you know, I really don't think that has any legs for this election. I think he really hasn't taken fire. I shouldn't put it that way. He hasn't become on fire in any of these countless debates. He seems to be laying back. He said that if he comes in a distant fourth in Iowa, he'll drop out. He's setting his own own barrier pretty low.
And his narrative is just, it's not much of a story at all. It just says that I'm the one who deserves to be president because I'm the most experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of, one can sense that coming from him, an almost a contempt for all of his opponents and even for the voters if they're not going to realize that he's the most able one. And so he just hasn't really excited very many people, even though, you know, he's been in the Senate for 35 years or whatever.
We've run out of time, but it's interesting that I've been getting messages from listeners, and they all have to do with the narratives, negative things. Why haven't you brought up this? Why haven't you brought up that? And they were largely things that were in the National Enquirer or other publications of that sort, suggesting that candidates had adulterous affairs and the rest of the world is not paying attention. So I guess people stick to also focus on the narratives that best express their personal inclinations.
Also, I mean, let's face it, there are some factual issues that can get in the way of a good story. And you know, the minute you start addressing a narrative that's riddled with inaccuracies, you restate it. It becomes more of a media trope, and it starts taking up residence in people's minds, and it gets harder and harder to dislodge. So to go and, you know, wading into waters of this person had an affair and this person took drugs and all of that, talk about its relevance, talk about its truth. I mean, why would you go there? You know, there was enough problems with the misinterpreting Al Gore. You know, Al Gore never said he invented the internet. Al Gore never said he was the star of Love Story, or, you know, these things were all shades.
And John Kerry was really not a hero after all.
Oh, and the whole Swift boat thing. I mean, that one was just a no-win situation. You couldn't leave it alone, but you couldn't fight it either. It was just a complete disaster.
Thank you both so much for talking with us today. Brooke Gladstone is co-host of On the Media. Paul Waldman is a senior fellow at Media Matters for America. His most recent book is Being Right is Not Enough.
Thank you.
Thank you.